me, therefore I seek worthier pastures and thereby restore self-esteem. How can you be so short-sighted to look never further than this week or next week, to have no impossible dream?
This is Mae Brussel. It's tape number 443, May the 30th, 1980, and it's side two.
Delighted to witness me tackle the world's greatest problem, from water pollution. No hope of solution, even if I live for 100 years.
One of the subscribers to these tapes sent me a page from a book on the life of Queen Victoria, and the statement that she was very anxious to make war with the Russians, that if she were a man, she'd give the Russians a beating, and that she wouldn't be satisfied until they could fight it out. But this intertwining link of competition between Russia and England is interesting in the Nobel family, and there have been books or studies that I've referred to on other tapes that the Russians were promised the techniques of railroads and industrialization to produce and transport their oil in exchange for their helping the North at the time of the American Civil War, and the suggestion and implication that the killing of Lincoln had as much to do with his cooperating with Russia against Great Britain as for many other reasons, that Abraham Lincoln had to be murdered because of this. There has always been a battle over the seas and across the continents to capture and gain land, and Queen Victoria was very much a part of those land grabs. And I suppose she would like to have taken on the Soviet Union in many ways. I got another article from back east from another subscriber, a very interesting one by Alexander Cockburn and James Ridgway on Tehran and Iran, because we all know that there are many elements going on and combating each other that have not been told to us about the taking of the hostages or why events are transpiring in the Middle East with our fleet there and our getting us on the stage of World War III because of those hostages at the embassy. And this article brings up something that I haven't understood, and I want to share it with you, and maybe we'll put our heads together on it. At the time when the Shah was kicked out of the country, the embassy in Washington had many files. They intimated and even acknowledged of various members of Congress that were in the pay of the Shah of Iran about the terrible Savak in the United States, and certainly the Savak must be existing in some form in Iran right now. All of those people, the military, police, and so forth, didn't suddenly become anti-Shah. They're playing some role there. And this article is about the fifth column, who was waiting in Tehran, and one aspect they brought up, they call it, in the Village Voice, the buried past. A remarkable aspect of the Iranian Revolution is that the secrets of the quarter century of tyranny still remain hidden. If the Shah was so bad and kicked out, why are they keeping the secrets? And they said, amid the unceasing hubbub of anti-American rhetoric, the leaders of the revolution have had remarkable discretion in disclosing the dealings of the Shah, of various foreign corporations, of politicians, of journalists, and government officials. And they bring up the fact, why are they holding this back? If the Shah was so bad, if the journalists have been paid off in America, if the public officials are in the pay of this kind of a regime all these years, and they have information on it, why are they letting this out? I know that the Panamanian group were presented with 600 pages of documents on problems, torture, and killings in Iran. That was presented the day that the Shah arrived. But that's been suppressed and hasn't been printed. The United Nations sent a group over to investigate the crimes of the Shah, representatives from different countries, headed by Mr. Waldheim, and we've never seen a printed page of what the Iranian people told them. Well, if they're making hundreds of pages of documents, why don't they present some of this to show what was going on? Who in the government is suppressing this? They had pictures on television of the shredding machines that only cut in lines, and they put together, women were putting together all the pieces of documents of intelligence operations, and yet they don't reveal what they glued together. Is this the bargaining power for later to keep us from further activity there, or when are they ever going to produce this information? Now, the Village Voice give some examples. They said shortly after the Shah fled Cairo and the embassy in Iran, the Washington embassy was taken over by the revolutionaries. Reporters clamored for public disclosure of what were damning documents concerning payoffs and bribes of people in the United States. Acting ambassador to the United States, Rouhani, claimed he sent these files back to Tehran. In Tehran, Mr. Rouhani's father, Mr. Yazdi, Y-A-Z-D-I, a close associate of Khomeini, said that the files were lost. This would be the best leverage Khomeini could have if he really wanted them. They give another example. Last summer, a visit to the Ministry of National Guidance in Tehran spotted on the cluttered desk of the Secretary to Minister Minaha several letters disclosing payoffs from the Shah to the United States government, to American journalists. The Secretary was preparing to throw the letters in the wastebasket. The visitor said, could he take them? And after much discussion, this person became involved. He proposed to copy the letters and deliver them to the visitor, but when the visitor left, these copies never arrived. They evidently were destroyed. And they point attention to the fact that withholding of information would buttress, by withholding this information, it would buttress the support of the previous regime. And by not exposing the Shah and his accomplices and agents, the beneficiaries are using it for some purpose. But I can't imagine why they're holding it back unless they're part of the CIA group that put in Khomeini and Ghozbadeh, and all of them are actually working for the CIA. The Shah is out and we control both governments. They said within a month of the seizure of the power, Ayatollah Taleghani, key member of the Revolutionary Council, informed another visitor that the council had reached a consensus. The revolution would mount a third world equivalent of a Nuremberg tribunal and would bring up all the parties of the Shah that would be brought to trial, and they would bring up before the tribunal. But the curtain was abruptly dropped on the idea of the tribunal. And it goes into other people who had information of atrocities and pictures of tortures and victims, and they were going to have 500 material witnesses. To nothing came of this. And they noted the suppression of evidence and rapid extermination of witnesses soon provoked a question. Who had such a manifest interest in the Iranian government that's there now to hide the deeds and the data of the Shah's years? And why are they hiding it? In any post-revolutionary situation, they would be delighted to display this information to justify what they are doing. And they go into Ghozbadeh and Bashida himself and various persons in the government, Yazdi, that are not allowing this information out, that are protecting the Shah, protecting the past administration. And how much of a revolution can it be if they refuse to reveal or destroy the evidence that they're talking about? This article calls attention to the fact that many of the Shah regime lived abroad. Mr. Behesti was in West Germany. Three were in the United States. Their past appears murky. They were all activists in the Muslim Student Organization, the MSA. The MSA is linked to the American Friends of the Middle East. That's a group that Leon Jaworski and John Connolly and the Southern group particularly were linked with for years. The Friends of the Middle East has been identified as a CIA organization, a conduit of CIA money. One of the directors was Kermit Roosevelt, who put the original coup in, that put the Shah into power against Premier Mossadegh, and two of their leaders, Tehram and Yazdi, I don't know if I pronounced them right, left the MSA, that's the Muslim Student Association, and now are active in the anti-Shah group in the early 60s. But the article points out that the lines between the CIA and the different groups are blurred, that there's a connection between the Muslim Student Association and the Central Intelligence Agency, and it goes on to other points in the article, but the important thing is that everywhere along the line, they talk about the crimes, but they don't reveal them. They could expose the people in Congress who are in the pay of the Shah, and they don't. They could expose the journalists in the United States who were under the pay of the Shah, but they don't. How long are they going to hold us back, or is all of this being destroyed? Or was the Shah moved out so a new group would come to power, but the new group have influence just as great? Now, I ask this question because I keep bringing this up over and over. that I believe one of the most lucrative and most important elements in the entire world today is the role of narcotics and organized crime, gun smuggling and narcotics, and then with it goes extortion, blackmail, prostitution, gambling, and all the rackets and business franchises of the crime syndicate. When the Shah was moved out, the narcotics market just poured and gushed. This new administration has allowed that to be possible, and I wonder if the crimes of the Shah were so much greater than the fact that they wanted to take over the opium, narcotics, hashish traffic from the entire Middle East and take it away from the Shah's family and exchange the distributors. There is a narcotics war going on now among the top bosses, but the crimes of the Shah aren't as important as the billions and billions of dollars that are pouring into this country in narcotics. And I think the secret to the change of governments in Iran has as much to do with narcotics, war, and traffic as it has to do with the crimes of the Shah. There's an article on heroin cost cuts police probe in Washington, D.C. The fact that it's hard to find heroin agents because they have to have cash to make a fix, and an ounce of heroin of pure quality is now selling for $12,000, if that's possible. It's hard to believe, but that's what they say. 4 years ago, the price was $1,400. So an ounce of gold doesn't sell for $12,000, and the name of the game really has to be the narcotic market. And the market is never-ending, and once the traffickers get hands on those huge kinds of profits, there's no way to end the spiraling, and the supply just keeps going on and on. There's no way to cut it off. There was an article about I.F. Stone in the Chicago Sun-Times. Ex-muckraker covers the Greek beat, and it tells how he's translating Cicero and various writers, Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, and so forth, his love of Plato and Greek. I.F. Stone is the great godfather of the so-called pseudo-liberal left in this country, a member of the OSS. He ran a newspaper during the Vietnam-South Korean War, his little newsletter. His role is to constantly put down any suggestion of a conspiracy in the United States, a conspiracy to kill John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. I don't see how a man who was involved with social problems and social progress or the decline of any part of our society could suddenly change roles and go away just into the classical field and ignore what is happening today. He's been a provocateur. He's been controversial. I've been accused of suggesting that he was in the pay of the employment agencies. If you watch Philip Agee's three-part series on television, I mentioned it several weeks ago, on the CIA. The CIA doesn't have to infiltrate the private clubs, the yacht clubs, the Harvard Crimson, the Princeton organizations. They take the left. They have left journalists, left labor leaders, left women's movement groups, left organizations, because those are the ones they want to take over, disrupt, break up, discredit. If any organization of a small group is making progress, the agent ratio is about 1-6 or 1-5. You don't have to have a card to say, I am a member of the CIA, to help the CIA or the American Gestapo. All you have to do is break apart and break the credibility of those people who are exposing the system and turn on them and get people to turn their back on those people and not to listen. And I.F. Stone has been a very valuable provocateur in that sense of diverting people from the very important truths that are going on. And then he took the cop out and went into his classical literature at a time when it was very important to make the connecting links of fascism around the world and at home to various election mismanagements, assassinations, conspiracies, the way we're losing what was given to us in the Constitution by purposeful manipulation. Anybody with an ounce of curiosity shouldn't drop out from his investigation. He should stay with it as long as he's alive. There's a book out that the National Labor Caucus is putting down naturally. They go ad infinitum about it. They're making such a big scene. I haven't read this book, but it's another one that I want to get. The Aquarian Conspiracy, Personal and Social Transformation in the 80s by Marilyn Ferguson. The idea is that you have a leaderless society, that you have a powerful network working to bring about radical change in the United States. That's the theme of the book, to bring in human consciousness of people who are against the kind of violences that are taking place, but who are not an organization. They believe that America should be free, that the states and the country should be free, and that there is a conspiracy among the Aquarian Age to drop out and get it together psychologically and psychically to resist war and weapons to create what she describes as a better world, a continuation of what happened in the 60s taking place in the 80s. I would say that there is a lot of basis for what is referred to as the Aquarian conspiracy, at least among many of the people I know, to drop out and individually do your part and not be part of the war machine or the mechanics, but not belong to an organization. Organizations are taken over. Organizations are infiltrated. There is used to be power in numbers, but there isn't anymore. And unless we can figure things out ourselves with a higher ideal or a goal, there never are going to be changes in society. I don't know if we can get enough people to figure it out themselves. They're so brainwashed between the media and television and radio and narcotics and alcohol, tobacco, poison food, and so forth. I don't know whether the body is capable of resisting the double whammy it's getting with all the poisons and chemicals that do get to the brain. But I believe that the idea of the Aquarian Age of not having organizations is important. And I will read the book, but the Labor Caucus is fighting it very hard, and yet I think that's important as owning a weapon is the state of mind of what you want and then being able to bring it about psychically. I think that that is one of the possibilities of counteracting some of these evil forces today. This doesn't sound very practical to some of you, I know, and I think I could go both ways. I think I could get very radical and violent if the time came, and I think I can stay psychically attuned to figuring out some of the problems and seeing them unravel. Without the bullets flying, there is an awful lot coming out these days. The problem of psychosurgery is in the news again. It seems that these old evils, these evil people, these evil acts keep recurring over and over again. The Washington Post has an article that the Cabinet of Health and Human Services, the Secretary Patricia Hearst, is considering the use of Medicaid and Medicare money for brain operations. They're trying to limit the use of psychosurgery operations, they meaning Dr. Peter Bragan. I'll give you his address. He's one of the best, most dedicated public servants, freedom fighters in the United States. And that bibliography that I have of important books to read, I should, those of you who don't have it should receive a copy from me. Send a self-addressed stamped envelope if you don't have this list of books. I made this list out a few years ago of important books to read, and I'll send you a list. And in the order of importance of books that you should have to understand these various conspiracies, I listed first Project Paperclip by Clarence Lansby, the importation of these Nazi criminals who are also part of this psychosurgery program, Kukrige's book, Galen's Spy of the Century, then my three articles, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? The Senate Select Committee is part of the cover-up, and the SLA is the CIA. Then under that was Dr. Peter Bragan, Center for Study of Psychiatry. You should get his books, Right to Research, and get the books on mind control, particularly the one by Dr. Delgado at Yale. And then the next group of researchers, the most important group, are Vaughn Young from Freedom, who's written a book on Interpol with the links of the Odessa, the Nazis, the drug connections, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and so forth. And then Jim Hogan's article, A Surfeit of Spies, on Intertel, which is the Justice Department, the FBI, and federal agents running Resorts International and gambling in casinos in Bahamas and Nevada, and also now in New Jersey. Those are terribly important to read. The Paperclip, the Galen, my articles, the one by Peter Bragan, his group, and you can send to him. He has tape cassettes, and he has books. He has a tape on the politics of psychosurgery and the story of Interpol, the Operation Ajax, and also Intertel. But Bragan is fighting again in Congress. They want to use the psychosurgery. They did lobotomies between 1940 and 1950. 40 to 50,000 Americans had brain operations, and now they do them quite neat with a needle that goes through the eye. They don't even open up the whole skull and affect a part of the brain. I wonder, besides the corrupt voting machines, how these 40 or 50 lobotomized people are voting. There's no law against going to the voting machines and just plunking your hand down for a vote, But I wonder how many of those even had lobotomies and know who they're voting for. There's no correlation between mental sickness and the ability to vote. And these people are out in society. They're not labeled. And goodness knows how many of them just had their thinking and their politics and their emotions removed. Well, now they want to use federal money again to bring back the lobotomies, and Dr. Bragan wants to stop it. Again, Dr. Thomas Ballantyne from Massachusetts General Hospital, he's pushing this psychosurgery, this mutilation of the brain. Dr. Peter Bragan is trying to stop it. And a Charles Krauthammer, I don't know if he's a Project Paperclip Krauthammer or not, he's the science director for HHS, Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Administration in Rockville. And these people are trying to rationalize the use of prefrontal lobotomies and psychosurgery one more time. It's interesting that very clean-cut men in business suits with Harvard, New England accents, and working at these Massachusetts hospitals debate the value of psychosurgery and lobotomies back and forth, but they don't parade the patients. How come they don't parade those patients? A listener from New York sent me an article on Leonard Keeley. I'm going to share that with you and do one whole tape soon on updating of mind control. I want to do one update on the Alternative 3 and the space program, and I'll get back to mind control later. I'll take a few of these isolated articles and do that as an entire subject on the effect of these people at Massachusetts General. And the very people that want to do this work were stopped by Sam Ervin and the House, the Senate Committee in 1975 from some of their shenanigans. But we keep going back to the Middle Ages. If you don't study the past and the history, if you don't get active in these things now, if you don't know the cast of characters, the others keep going and come back with a new power resurgence, and you have to keep watching them all the time. I mentioned tapes a while back, the two of the doctors involved with the mind processing, the psychosurgery, and so forth, were also involved with becoming experts on the prison riots in New Mexico, where the 39 informers were murdered that evening. The files were taken out, and the cell was broken down, and these people were killed. We haven't heard a word about that. That's been very quiet, the investigation of the prison riots, and again, I suppose we never will hear too much about that, even though there's some lawsuits pending. They'll be about as effective as the Kent State lawsuits and be lost for posterity. The facts of that case will never be told. There's an investigation going on in the House of Representatives about airplanes carrying explosives, safety of transportation. Mr. John Burton from California has been challenging some of the Federal Aviation Administration people. And again, at this trial came up the fact that the Chilean airline brings in explosives that prior to the time that Letelier was killed in the United States, Orlando Letelier, the former Chilean ambassador, they brought in explosives on passenger airplanes before and after, and a non-pilot landed an airplane in Chile with the explosives on it, that airplanes coming in from other countries are transporting themselves back and forth and bringing ammunition into the United States and out, and then some of it is later being used to kill people inside the United States. DINA, the Chilean secret police, works closely with the police in Washington, D.C., and of course the headquarters for all of their operations are down in Colonial Dignidad, the same house, camp, farm, religious, church, front that holds Nazi war criminals, the border between Argentina and Chile, that were responsible for the killing of Letelier and Sandra Moffat in Washington, D.C. So now they're investigating airplanes carrying explosives, but the people in Chile that were responsible for the murders in the United States have never been sent here and never will be. They're responsible for those murders in Washington. These bombs and their explosives, according to these allegations of various witnesses and Michael Townley, particularly, he carried explosives right in the passenger compartment of transportation planes that were used for regular passenger use, and that the explosives are kept on these kinds of planes, and that the security is lax at the airport. They let them through, and they can carry the explosives with them. Dr. Ernest Lefevre, according to the Washington Post, a president of the Washington-based Ethics and Public Policy Center, which has been nothing but a CIA front, asked the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence that Congress let the clergy be CIA agents, the journalists be CIA agents, the missionaries can work for the CIA, that the CIA should be able to pose as a journalist, to pose as a geologist, or even a medical missionary. In other words, the CIA should be allowed to do anything it has to do, and if you go to a priest, if you go to a newspaper man with a story, if you see a crime committed and you go to a journalist, you won't know if that is a journalist or a member of the SAVAK or the Gestapo or the DINA or the CIA. You will not be able to tell the story to the journalist because if the journalist is an agent, he will not carry it on. Now, this isn't a hypothetical. This has been going on continuously. The stories of the assassinations in this country, the murders, the connecting links of murders to people high up in government is given to journalists and they kill the story. People disguised as writers kill the story, receive documents that they never pass on, don't want the stories to be carried. And at the time of the Senate hearings, Senator Church's hearings on the CIA, I think it came out that there were 250 journalists that belonged to the intelligence community. So whatever this organization is, the Ethics and Public Policy Center, I'm sure it's funded by the Defense Department or the National Security Agency. And when the CIA needs a new charter or needs to justify its infiltration behind its clerical garb or its typewriter or whatever, you know, a geologist is looking for rocks and he's actually spying or sabotaging on a country. When your scientists and your priests and your press all turn to spies, you get a reign of terror that never can be undone. This is happening right now, and I'm sure Latin and South America and Asia and all over the world. If you go to the priest, if you go to the rabbi, if you go to the newspaper person, if you have something to tell to somebody and you're afraid or you've seen something wrong, and that person is an agent, what happens is the person who tells or sees gets killed. It's like the fellow in New York that gets killed because he saw the Eppolito murder and was asked to testify. The one who sees it gets off. And the journalist, the priest, the scientist, keeps the secret and works for the government. The government, whether, again, it's DINA, SAVAK, Gestapo, CIA, National Security Agency, there are no boundaries, and this is the way the government is taken over between the satellite communication systems and all sources of privacy and information being run by a select few. There is nowhere for the people to possibly turn. There is another point I want to bring up with you on this tape that I think you have to consider seriously. And even though I keep hitting at Jimmy Carter and the drug connections, I will be getting to Ronald Reagan and the fascist connections in the next week or two and pulling out of my file some of the great Reagan stories from when he was governor of California. To tell you the truth, I think I've actually avoided it. It's like sitting down and eating your own puke. The idea that you've seen this man hand-selected as a president of the United States 12 or 15 years ago, and then you watch him move up and up and up, it's outrageous. Now, what is the other choice? It's Jimmy Carter with Brzezinski running the saddle with his team in the White House, weapons in hand. I don't think they would kill Jimmy Carter to have Mondale as president of the United States, so there'd have to be a double coup where the president and the vice president are killed at the same time. But if it's Jimmy Carter and Brzezinski, because Brzezinski really runs the White House, forget Mondale. If it's Jimmy Carter and Brzezinski versus Ronald Reagan and Mr. Casey and the Gestapo from the Hoover Library out here in California, there is one primary difference, and you have to watch that very, very closely. And that is that there are justices on the Supreme Court that would be replaced. And don't believe for one second that there is any similarity between a Jimmy Carter selection and a Ronald Reagan selection. Ronald Reagan has said that he doesn't believe you have to have a lawyer as a justice of the Supreme Court. He made a Mr. Clark from San Luis Obispo a justice, a non-lawyer. He believes that corporate heads should be heads of the Supreme Court. Jimmy Carter, in his 3 years as president, has had a high percentage of liberals on the court. He's tried to use women and minorities, and he's tried to be fair, and Ronald Reagan wouldn't. And if you have to face the future with justices of the Supreme Court, even if Ronald Reagan only lives 1 year after, you're going to live with those justices. So there is no way to divide the vote, to go for anyone like Anderson or these splinter parties or to be really crazy or even to write in May Brussel. There's no way to split the vote if it's Reagan versus Jimmy Carter when it comes to that, because the selection of the justices is terribly important. 5 U.S. justices are over 70 years of age. Mr. Brennan, the senior, is 74. He's had radiation treatment for a malignant tumor on his vocal cords, and he had a stroke last year. Thurgood Marshall is 71. He's overweight. He's 13 years on the bench. He's not in good health. He's had mild heart attacks, and he's missed 200 cases from the last year because he fell and hit his head and his elbow and his wrist. There was a suggestion in an article in Sanse Mercury last week or so that maybe these ailing justices should get off the bench and retire while Jimmy Carter's still president and not give in that the seats be filled by Ronald Reagan. That is possible, but not probable. This is a dangerous age of rigged voting machines, political assassinations, corrupt and stupid leaders, but out of it we have to find some sanity. I hope you do. Have a good week. The time is out, and we'll be back with these corruptions again next week. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California.